This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, an interview from this fall with former Michigan Congressman Bart Stupak. He joined us in October to discuss his book about the process that led to the Affordable Care Act. But first, in February of 2016, six people were killed and two others were seriously injured during a shooting rampage in the Kalamazoo area. Jason Dalton, who was working as an Uber driver that night, was arrested hours later. But as 2017 comes to a close, it's not clear when his case will go to trial. We're going to discuss some of the things which have delayed a trial for Dalton with Tanya Krause-Phelan. She is professor at Western Michigan University's Thomas M. Cooley Law School and previously worked as a defense attorney and public defender. Thanks for being with us again.
You're welcome.
How unusual is this particular case that we are now almost 2 years removed from the actual crime, and yet, as we sit here and talk, a trial date is not scheduled?
Well, generally speaking, for people who are incarcerated in jail, the system likes to make sure that there is a speedy trial. But as we see in the Dalton case, there are some things that can slow it down. As of a few months ago, one of the most recent statistical data forms I looked at said that the average wait time for a felony trial in the country is anywhere from 6 to 18 months for an incarcerated defendant. What happens, however, when there is an issue as to the defendant's competency to stand trial or insanity at the time the crime was committed, everything is put on hold. The whole process is put on hold because the first thing that has to happen is the defendant has to have a mental health examination, and that can cause a delay as well because at that point, the criminal justice system has to wait on the mental health system to perform its duties. The legal system then gets reports from the mental health system and then has to make a decision if they can go forward from there. So it does elongate the process quite a bit when mental health issues are involved and mental health defenses or potential defenses are raised.
And Jason Dalton was found competent to stand trial, but as you have told us before, that is one ruling, and it's possible that that could be explored again. On top of that, that competent to stand trial does not rule out an insanity defense. Is an insanity defense somewhat more complicated than something along the lines of either saying, no, he's not the responsible party, or perhaps trying to claim that there were mitigating circumstances?
Yes, they are different. Competency to stand trial it's a constitutional due process concept. What we're looking at in that situation is, does the defendant, with his or her current mental state of mind, do they understand what they're charged with, and can they reasonably participate with their defense counsel in the case? And competency, as you mentioned, is an issue at any point in the trial. Now, obviously, that is one of the reasons that when the issue of competency is raised, we take a time out because we have to make sure that the person can meet those two criteria before we continue with the charges against them. That whole concept is fundamental fairness in how we prosecute people. Insanity, on the other hand, is we're looking back in time and trying to determine what was the defendant's state of mind at the time the alleged acts were committed. And the standard for insanity varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, but for the most part, it can be summarized by saying we're looking at whether or not at the time the acts were committed, the defendant had some disease or defect of the mind, and whether that disease or defect of the mind affected the individual's behavior. Quite simply, that's the insanity defense. Was he insane at the time he committed the crime?
In this particular case, there was the competency exam, which found Jason Dalton competent to stand trial, and it looked like there was going to be a trial held during the summer. And that has not happened, in part because the defense has been appealing the admissibility of statements made to police. You know, if we have multiple issues here, you know, insanity defense and then the question of admissibility of statements made by the defendant, is it one thing on top of another, which therefore just leads to a longer delay?
It could. With an appeal that happens while a case is pending, that's typically referred to as an interlocutory appeal. And the higher appellate courts will take an issue in the middle of a pending case if it is of a critical nature and it could affect the outcome of the trial. And if it is an interlocutory appeal, it, of course, again, puts a timeout on the case. Everything stops until the appellate court decides that issue. Now, one of the things that a defense attorney would obviously want to look at is if there was an issue of competency at the time of the trial, even if it's later ruled, you know, a year, year and a half, 2 years later, that he's competent right now, that doesn't mean that he might have been incompetent or there might have been some issue with his ability to either waive his Miranda rights according to the rules or understand what he was saying. So I'm not surprised at all that defense counsel has challenged statements that were made to the police if there were, in fact, some issues as to his competency.
And is there a lot for a judge to consider there? You know, when were the Miranda rights read? What were the circumstances? And again, also trying to determine the defendant, in this case, Jason Dalton's state of mind at the time he was talking to police. Is that a lot for a judge to weigh when trying to figure out whether or not those statements are going to be admissible?
It is. There are a lot of things that the judge has to factor in. And if the interrogation sessions or the statements in question were recorded, the judge not only can look at the words that are in the police officer's report about what the defendant said, but the judge could also look at the tapes and have an idea based on body language or the tone of voice or the inflection. So judges would have that available in cases where things were actually recorded. But again, if somebody is in custody and they're being interrogated by police, the law is very clear. They have to be given Miranda warnings unless one of two exceptions exist. And if a defendant decides to talk to police after they've been given their Miranda warnings, they have to waive it. And that waiver has to be done, what the law says, as knowingly, intelligently, and voluntary. So when you consider that phrase that we need for the Miranda waiver, again, it's not surprising that defense counsel is challenging perhaps that is an issue at the time he made his statements, given that there was a competency issue as well.
So we have an insanity defense, we have the competency exam, we have the question over admissibility of statements to police. On top of that, this is a trial where there is a lot of attention from organizations like ours, but not just ones in Southwest Michigan, but across the country. There has been interest in this case. Is that one more thing that the judge has to think about here when setting a trial date, is that there's going to be a lot of attention focused and you have to consider how that could affect the right to a fair trial?
Absolutely. That is something that the trial judge should and will take into account. With high-profile cases, there's a series of things that a judge can do, or I should say a number of things a judge can do, to make an effort to ensure that the jurors that are being selected for the case can be fair and impartial. And that's the standard. To serve as a jury, they have to demonstrate, first of all, that they're eligible, that their right to be on a jury hasn't been removed, but also that they can be fair and impartial. And just because somebody has seen an article or heard a segment on the news about the case doesn't mean that they can't sit as a juror. They have to say they haven't formed an opinion on the case and that they can listen to all of the evidence throughout the trial in a fair and impartial way. In a case like this, it wouldn't be uncommon for a judge to do what's referred to as individualized voir dire. And what happens there is the prosecutor, the defense attorney, a court reporter, and the judge will go in the judge's chambers and they will question that individual one-on-one. What articles have you read? What have you seen on TV? What have you heard on the radio? Have you formed an opinion? Have you talked to anybody about the case? Did you post anything on social media about this case? Again, the whole goal is to make sure that that person hasn't formed an opinion about the case. In a case like this, quite frankly, I think the judge, the prosecutor, and the defense attorney are going to have their hands full trying to find people who may have not formed an opinion about the case.
Especially difficult if you're going to keep the trial in Kalamazoo County, where probably most people can tell you when it was and where they were when they first heard that this was going on.
Sure, sure. And so I would anticipate the judge is going to make every effort to keep the case in Kalamazoo County, take all due caution and care to make sure that they select fair and impartial jurors. There is an extreme measure that the judge could take as well, and that is if they're able to pick 12-plus people, and I say plus because in a case like this, they'd probably pick anywhere between 2 to 4 alternates to sit along with the 12 people in the jury box, just in case something comes up, you know, then they don't have to declare a mistrial because one of their jurors is ill or whatever. But what will happen is, in a rare case, if the judge thinks it's necessary to keep outside media reports, reporters, and things like that from tainting the jurors, the judge can sequester those jurors throughout the trial, and you know, they'd stay in a hotel, and you know, they would be escorted by court officials when they went to lunch, or lunch would be brought in for them. That happens very rarely, but it is something available to the judge.
And if a jury is sequestered in this day and age, do you then also have to take their mobile phones, you know, so that they're not getting text messages or looking at, you know, their Twitter app, which might have, you know, news updates in it?
You know, that raises a great question. To my knowledge, I don't know of a case where the judge has actually confiscated the cell phones, but I think certainly the court can make the jurors take an oath that they are not going to use any technology to access sources that they've been told they can't look at.
The last time we had you on, Tanya, you mentioned that there was the possibility that the defense could ask to have a change of venue for a trial. Mm-hmm. In other words, say that in this particular location, it's just impossible to get a fair trial. So if the defense makes that motion, we don't know that they will yet, but if they do, what does the judge weigh? How do they determine whether or not, yes, this case can't be tried here?
The judge has to look at the nature of the media coverage. And in today's age, we can take a sampling, for example, of what's being reported on social media, on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. And you'll have a sense of what the general attitude in the public is about this particular case. Back when I was trying cases, that wasn't even an issue. But now a judge can look at that information. But again, along with the amount of coverage, the type of coverage, we also have to consider, can the judge pick a jury that says they can be fair and impartial and haven't formed an opinion? So what I would anticipate happening in this case is defense counsel is likely going to raise it as a pretrial motion. As part of that pretrial motion, I would anticipate the defense attorney to attach exhibits of newspaper articles, transcripts of radio shows, interviews, things like that. And maybe they'll even take a sampling, a poll. If that pretrial motion is brought and is denied, look for a second attempt at that motion after the jury selection process, because that's the final thing I wanted to point out. It's possible that the judge to whom this case is assigned goes through all the very strict measures to ensure that they pick a fair trial, you know, a set of jurors who are fair and impartial. They may get to that end of that process and come to the conclusion, you know what? We're going to have a hard time picking a jury in Kalamazoo. The defense could renew the motion, and if jury selection goes badly, the judge might, in fact, grant a change of venue at that point. There's a preference to keep the trials in the jurisdiction where the jurisdiction and venue where it occurred. It's easier for witnesses to be brought into the trial. It's easier for the prosecutor with all of the evidence and law enforcement officers who are right there in Kalamazoo County. So that's the starting point. There's a preference to keep the trial where the case happened.
And if you move it, are you limited as to how far away you can move it? Because you're right, there are witnesses who live in this area, and it would be very inconvenient for them if you moved the trial a great distance. So do you have to find some place where you say, we've gotten just far enough away that the media coverage wasn't as great, but not so far away that, you know, we make it really impossible for a witness to get to trial and to offer their testimony?
Yeah, and there's no hard and fast rule. There's no set number of miles or number of counties away. And I think you summed it up very well. You have to get just far enough away that you have people who haven't seen or heard a lot about the case so that they've formed opinions. But keep in mind, the prosecution also has a right to a fair trial, and that ability to present their witnesses and their evidence is part of that. So it has to be close enough, far enough yet close enough, that the prosecutor has the ability to effectively present their case.
You mentioned as we started here that there is the right to a speedy trial. Is that the
Is that
the defendant's right to a speedy trial that we're talking about? And in this case, can we say that the defendant has decided to take other legal options, which therefore, in effect, the defendant is saying, this is more important to me than having a speedy trial?
Yes. Yes. And that's why I mentioned, when I was referring to the timeouts, anytime the defendant requests something like a mental health examination so that competency can be determined or insanity, when I say take a timeout, that stops the speedy trial clock. And if essentially, that is a waiver of speedy trial at that point in time. Now, once those reports come back in on the competency and in the insanity, it's time back in. And when we say time back in, then the speedy clock trial starts ticking again. So essentially, anytime the defendant raises an issue like that, it doesn't erase the right to be having a speedy trial, it just elongates what speedy trial means in that case.
Tanya Krause-Phelan is a professor at the Western Michigan University Thomas M. Cooley Law School. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure.